Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 146 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, memoirist and travel writer Horatio Clare ponders the necessary pragmatism of the professional writer and shares a glimpse of what writers really talk about amongst themselves. Following Horatio, poet Clare Pollard celebrates the playfulness and variety of nonsense verse, sharing examples from across the centuries. First up, here's Horatio Clare with Crafty Writing.
There is a street-fighting aspect to the craft of writers which is noticeable when you meet successful ones. Though often pacific and almost always opponents of violence, still they engage in battles, skirmishes and wars. Writing well is a battle, being published is a battle, being reviewed, being remunerated, selling a lot of books, selling oneself as a writer and performer, commanding advances, the bigger the better, earning and cementing a reputation. These are hard-fought things. The doughty resolution, the willingness to do pretty well anything and go through anything in pursuit of triumph seems to inculcate and reward a matter-of-fact professional ruthlessness. I do not mean a willingness to do down or do ill. Rather, a willingness to do by any means necessary was my secret motto during the writing of A Single Swallow, which I reprised during the research and construction for Down to the Sea and Ships. For example, I met a great Irish novelist in an hotel after he performed at a festival. We talked about who was good at the moment, our competition as well as inspirations, who represented them, whether they, the agents and publishers, were doing a good job, and in general terms, what the market was doing. At the same festival, I discussed favourite poems and what was good and where and whom it was borrowed from and career progression with a formidably successful pair of writers. There was little romance in these exchanges, yet my interlocutors are among the most lyrical and resonant writers of the age. Nor was it something in my personality or agenda which raised these issues. These are standard writers' conversations. We talk less, except perhaps when teaching Arvon or university courses, about applying the same approach to the hunt for subjects, images, phrases, words. But here we are even more ferocious. Anything and anywhere can be material. Most of us gather obsessively, continuously, and routinely, consciously. Having a pen and paper by your bed is all very well, but it does not compare, in my experience, with maintaining a sentry-like watchfulness most days, in most situations, for free material, or that which may be lifted, shaped, written, and sold. Do not underestimate us. The novelist's trade, the any kind of writer's trade, descends, in Europe anyway, from the troubadours, travelling storytellers, often all singing, all dancing types, who also founded the acting profession. You would need to be streetwise, alert and focused if you were one of them, and something of a street fighter to flourish, perhaps. None of this will surprise any who have writer friends on Facebook. Just now, one of mine posted, "Does anyone know a modernist house in Cornwall? I keep thinking of setting part of a new novel in one, but maybe remembering Poirot." The writer this morning is looking for help, material, detail and plot, while defraying anxiety of influence. There are certain tricks which, like the troubadours, one learns to do well in time. Reading. You can study half a library without making yourself a much better writer. But read certain books, some the right ones for you and some key for any writer, and you can advance in great leaps, given some talent. The names of these most writers tend to know, and any new they find they share with peers when they meet. There's no need to be secretive with sources, for they give idiosyncratically to different readers, so we swap names without hesitation. Talking about books, especially books with an edge, with something to say or some telling method, being one of life and the trade's great pleasures. So, you discuss dialogue with Neil Griffiths, and he will tell you about Ron Berry. You discuss Heaney with Nick Laird, and he will tell you where your favourite, in my case, poem is lifted from. Discuss nature writing with me, and I will mention B.B., Dennis Watkins Pitchford. Discuss the life, the writing life, and some writers will already be thinking of William Boyd's Any Human Heart. The reference is, "You choose the life, you take the consequences," spoken by Boyd's version of Hemingway to his friend, Boyd's hero, Logan Mountstuart. Travel writers have all read Jan Morris's Trieste and the Meaning of Nowhere, along with Naples 44 by Norman Lewis. Advances in form make us particularly vigilant. The middle section of Kevin Barry's Beetlebone, where he breaks out of the novel into a first-person type travel piece about writing the novel and then takes up the novel again. The prose and poetry of Max Porter's Grief is the Thing with Feathers. These have been much discussed among us this last year or two. They will soon be being imitated. I don't doubt they are being so now. The thing I look for, mostly unconsciously, is how other writers are in public. Who do their readers, who only know them from events and their work, think they are? Is it a construct? How much so, given that inevitably some of it is? The fit is mostly gentle and inimitable between the more private person and the public writer, but everyone has something to teach. How long do you take signing a book? Do you do drawings in it? One bestseller I know uses a special stamp in addition to a painstaking personal dedication, and I have seen him take 3 hours to satisfy a particularly long line. A bookseller told me it was a good idea to take as long as possible. It makes you look popular, and moreover, the longer you and the line are still there, the more likely other readers and shoppers are to join it, especially when the queue wanes. When signing stock, I was told, do a thorough job. Some shops will not be able to return placed and dated books to the publisher, forcing them to hold the copies and, hopefully, display them. And what about the stage show? Do you wear a hat? Smart or casual? Touring my Down to the Sea in Ships talk, which I performed in various versions all over Britain, Ireland, Italy, Gibraltar and China, I seriously toyed with having the venues play a warm-up track before I came on stage. I should have done it. That might have felt strange in an overwhelmingly empty theatre in Lerwick. In the children's book market, everyone seems to have instruments, props, drawing tricks, costumes, songs or assistants. And then there's the get-out, the skilful disappearance. A great writer, poet and performer I worked with for many years, Ian Macmillan, was a master of leaving them wanting more, utterly delighted to have invited him, lit up by the show, and swiftly. We would have said our thank yous and goodbyes and be in a taxi, leaving crews to dismantle the radio station they had built for us, quite correctly, busy presenters and producers not expected to carry gear, though we did that too, almost before anyone realised we were gone. Watch Jeff Dyer, a sort of anti-travel writer, arranging a taxi for his end of stint at festival. The transport desk are very competent, and they like to appear laid back and in control, naturally, but Dyer goes over every detail, timing and variable of his needs with a near-obsessive punctiliousness. Eavesdropping, it was like being in a comic Jeff Dyer story, and I wondered if he was working it slightly, in a reflex, prodding the situation slightly for material, which we all do sometimes. If you travel for work as a writer, seemed to be the message, travel exactly right. Not far down the line it will pay off. And if it goes awry, there's always the mental note, the notebook, the laptop, the page, the piece, the publication, the fee. Nothing bad can happen to a writer, said a young one of my acquaintance. It's all material. I applauded the thought. But then he sent a downcast message from the north, where he had played to a tiny crowd in a big tent and found the organisers had no stock for him to sign or sell, and then he had news that a serious proposal for his next book had been rejected. No craft or ruthlessness can get you out of those situations. A troubadour would have shrugged and put faith in more work and the changing of his luck, which my friend did. I do not think he is yet at the stage of putting all his festival requests through his agent and automatically copying publicists in. It seems unnecessary hassle all round, and there's the question of the agent taking a percentage of the fee. But he will learn they seldom do, and that this method has the magical effect of making it more likely venues will get copies of your work in. I like a venue with more copies than audience members, if it has to be one or the other. Helping the booksellers reload unsold boxes and lug them back to the shop is only decent, and it cannot but help your signed unsold copies find display space. If I sound ruthless and calculating, I am not. Most of these behaviours and acquired habits are common sense or normal courtesy, like Ian Macmillan answering all correspondence from readers, of which there is a great deal, generously and quickly. But I would not have minded if someone had let me in on a cheat sheet of a list of them when I was starting out. I will watch my young friend carefully for more tips when I see him. His big proposal found a publisher and an excellent advance. We mean to meet and talk, no doubt, shop.
That was Horatio Clare, recorded by James McConachy. You can find out more about Horatio on his website at www.horatioclare.co.uk. That's Claire, spelt C-L-A-R-E. Next, here's Claire Pollard with Serious Nonsense.
As a child, my pleasure in poetry was bound up with nonsense. My mum and I played rhyming games, generating gibberish. My mum loves to recount how I used to call marmalade cats jam hams. My first poetry book was Hilda Boswell's Treasury of Poetry, and my favourite page featured the nonsense poet Edward Lear's description of the Jumblies' cargo. And they bought an owl and a useful cart, and a pound of rice and a cranberry tart, and a hive of silvery bees. And they bought a pig and some green jackdaws, and a lovely monkey with lollipop paws, and 40 bottles of Ringbow Ree, and no end of Stilton cheese. The Jumblies' stoical voyage beneath a pea-green veil, their sieve filling with water, has always haunted me. There is a strange sadness about it that I've since discovered echoes through much of Edward Lear's work. Without being flippant, on some level it seems to fulfil T.S. Eliot's definition of genuine poetry as that which can communicate before it is understood. Lear was a Victorian, of course, and most of us think of nonsense verse as a 19th century invention. But the academic Noel Malcolm's book, The Origins of English Nonsense, makes a good case for it starting in the 17th century, with poets such as John Taylor. One of those marvellous eccentrics who dot the history of nonsense, John Taylor was known as the water poet, as he worked on the Thames as a kind of gondolier. A great self-publicist, Taylor became famous for travel writing stunts, such as an attempt to scull from London to the Isle of Sheppey in a brown paper boat with oars of salted dried fish. John Taylor was writing during the English Civil War, and it was perhaps this sense of a world turned upside down which inspired the genesis of nonsense. In his poem, Great Jack-o'-Lent, for example, the atmosphere is one of carnival and reversal. Taylor's poem begins by asking, "Is Shooter's Hill turned to an oyster pie, or may a maypole be a buttered place?" Place there spelt with an A-I, as in the fish. He goes on to talk of a humblebee killing a whale, hinting at the overturning of hierarchy and the executions that would hurl Britain into chaos, and finishes the poem with the lines, "He that of these lines doth make a doubt, let him sit down and pick the meaning out." I love John Taylor's ending there in Great Jack-o'-Lent. The challenge is the gauntlet of all nonsense poetry. Go on then, make sense of it if you can. Elsewhere, John Taylor was notable for his experiments in unmitigated gibberish. There are different types of nonsense verse, and perhaps the purest type uses nonsense language, as in his poem in the Utopian tongue. Thoitum as courier, tush rump, codsheady rusty, mungrelimo, wish wap, rage, dickety tottery. This is interesting in that it foregrounds letters as the building blocks of poetry. We start to think about the hardness of a t, the tenderness of a sh. It's the beginning of an experiment with sound that leads to Dadaist sound poetry at the Cabaret Voltaire in 1915, or Ted Hughes's attempt, in his epic collaboration with the director Peter Brooks, the play Orgast, to create a universal language. However, as Noel Malcolm argues, gibberish is capable of performing only one trick, which is to make funny noises. To achieve any other effects, it must dilute itself with words which are not nonsense. It is for this mixing of nonsense with sense that the great nonsense poets, the Victorians, Lewis Carroll and Edward Lear, are known. Lewis Carroll is another nonsense poet whose life fascinates in the contrast between his hallucinatory, subversive world and the reality of his life as a buttoned-up Victorian. Lewis Carroll was born Charles Dodgson in 1832, and though originally groomed for the ministry, he ended up a mathematician at Christ Church, Oxford, in the heart of the establishment. He had a stammer and referred to himself as the Dodo, Dodgson, hence the Dodo in Alice. He never married. Carol saw children as allies. Like him, they had to behave, abide by rules, be seen and not heard. But like him, he suspected they could see through the absurdity of adults. And children embraced Carol's anarchy. Again, his writing shows hierarchy turned upside down as he mocks the established rituals of society. School, royalty, the tea party, the croquet game, the fair trial, and mock sense. His nonsense poems are radical because, unlike the moralistic nursery verse of the time, they teach no lessons. Carroll loved inventing. Amongst other things, he invented a sort of double-sided sticky tape, a system of parliamentary representation, an alcohol measuring scale for his college common room, a gadget for helping the bedridden read books sideways, a steering device for a tricycle, a proto-version of Scrabble, and the doublet, better known as the word ladder, a puzzle where you change one word into another by altering one letter at a time, with each successive change being a genuine word, so rat becomes log via rot and lot. This is still used in newspapers today. Lewis Carroll also, of course, invented words, most famously in the Jabberwocky, galumphing and chortle. But what's noticeable is that, unlike John Taylor in his poem In the Utopian Tongue, when Lewis Carroll does this, he sprinkles nonsense with sense, keeping the logic of grammar but inventing words within this, as in the famous opening of the Jabberwocky, "'Twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe." "'Twas' and "'the' and "'did' are all plain English here, and do enough work to make it clear that toves and wabes are nouns, slithy an adjective, gyre and gimble verbs. Gimble, to take one example, is also a sort of compound or portmanteau word, mashing two others together. There's the ghost of gamble and nimble, so we imagine a playful, mischievous movement. Such poetry might be useful to writers, as it reminds us of Robert Frost's concept of the sound of sense. Through the rhythm and intonation of the line, we understand the kind of thing that is being communicated. However, making sense like this is also, in some regards, a trap, even as we're seduced into it. Alice asks Humpty Dumpty to explain the poem, and he declares airily that toves are something like badgers, something like lizards, and something like corkscrews, and that a rath is a sort of green pig. He is clearly making it up, trying to sound knowledgeable, as are we if we start asserting that we have decoded the poem. Carroll's later nonsense, his Hunting of the Snark or Walrus and the Carpenter, have an increasingly melancholy undertow. He has this in common with the other great nonsense poet, Edward Lear. Lear is also an intriguing character. The 20th of 21 children, neglected by his mother and inflicted by terrible epilepsy, which always made him feel an unmarriageable outsider. He was, despite this, or perhaps in part because of this, successful. One of the great ornithological illustrators, producing birds for both Gould's famous Book of Birds and The Zoology of the Voyage of the HMS Beagle, drawing master for Queen Victoria, and a friend and sometime member of the Pre-Raphaelites. His children's books became the most popular of their time, his limericks becoming part of nursery culture. Yet thinking himself a landscape painter, he gave his poems away cheaply and ended up struggling financially and feeling a failure. All Edward Lear's characters seem to be oddities, defiant eccentrics such as my beloved Jumblies, who go against all common sense in their voyage. They went to sea in a sieve, they did, in a sieve they went to sea, in spite of all their friends could say, on a winter's morn, on a stormy day, in a sieve they went to sea. And when the sieve turned round and round and everyone cried, you'll all be drowned, they called aloud, our sieve ain't big, but we don't care a button, we don't care a fig, in a sieve we'll go to sea. The essayist G.K. Chesterton's brilliant essay, A Defence of Nonsense from 1902, explains that, like Carroll, Edward Lear is always introducing scraps of his own elvish dialect into the middle of simple and rational statements, until we are almost stunned into admitting that we know what they mean. To Chesterton, something feels like common sense in the line from the poem The Pobble Who Has No Toes that states, "Everyone knows that a pobble is better without his toes." There is a tension here too, though. Such poems both mock our instinctive human drive towards sense-making and encourage it. Chesterton, elsewhere, argues that true nonsense resists analysis, claiming proudly, "No age except our own could have understood that the quangle-wangle meant absolutely nothing." Whereas if the dong with the luminous nose had appeared in the 17th century, everyone would have called it a dull satire on Oliver Cromwell. But then the essayist George Orwell has elsewhere claimed, persuasively, that the whole theory of authoritarian governments is summed up in the statement that pobbles are happier without their toes. Could both critics be correct? Maybe, as this brand of nonsense reveals the structures of language, particularly in Lear and Carroll, that of reason and authority, and so can seem satirical even as it flaunts its meaninglessness. It both has and eats its unbirthday cake. After pure nonsense, and that which mixes neologisms in with recognisable English, there is a final type of nonsense verse, where the words are recognisable, but the world is not. Take these opening lines from Edward Lear's most famous poem, The Owl and the Pussycat. "The owl and the pussycat went to sea in a beautiful pea-green boat. They took some honey and plenty of money wrapped up in a £5 note." This poem uses words you would find in a dictionary, but its randomness plunges us into a world of dream and is seen by some as opening the door to surrealism and its plundering of the unconscious. Conversely, this type of nonsense also teaches a way of reading that is about surface, with words chosen for musicality above content. It is ultimately up to us whether we choose a psychoanalytic reading of the honey and money or just notice that they rhyme. The former path leads us to contemporary surrealists like Salima Hill, the latter to lovers of wordplay such as Matthew Welton, who has said in an interview, "I'm not really interested in subject matter, I'm interested in form." Matthew Welton's poem, "This is Delicious to Say," always reminds me of the Jumbly's cargo with its list of foods. "Vodka she likes, whiskey also, and plums and limes and lemon peel, fried fruit, dry beans, deep soup, warm cream." So then, people think of nonsense poetry as trivial, but its possibilities are radical, both in its unfathomable depths and its playful surfaces. It is both deeply mysterious and profoundly shallow. Right now, I am introducing my 3-year-old son to nonsense poetry and often hear him reciting garbled scraps from the 20th century master Dr. Seuss, particularly the tongue-twisting Fox in Socks, which tells us that when beetles battle beetles in a puddle-paddle battle and the beetle-battle puddle is a puddle in a bottle, they call this a tweetle-beetle-bottle-puddle-paddle-battle-muddle and when beetles fight these battles in a bottle with their paddles and the bottle's on a poodle and the poodle's eating noodles, they call this a muddle-puddle-tweetle-poodle-beetle-noodle-bottle-paddle-battle. Dr. Seuss, Roald Dahl, Edward Gorey, Spike Milligan, all my favourite children's writers celebrate pure joy in language with a strong streak of nonsense, and they are starting to influence my own practice. Turning to adult poetry, after a few renditions of Dr. Seuss's Fox in Socks, I'm often struck by how sensible much of contemporary writing is. I can't help thinking a bit more gimbling wouldn't hurt.
That was Claire Pollard, recorded by Julia Copus. You can find out more about Claire on her website at clairepollard.wordpress.com. That's Claire, spelt C-L-A-R-E. And that concludes episode 146, which was produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 147, the novelist Cynthia Rogerson speaks with James McConaughey about the lengths she goes to ensure the realism of her characters, her dislike of positive discrimination, and the experience of being a serious novelist bundled into a chick lit cover. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.